Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm okay. I'm in New York, and I have a Jerry-built production set up here. The camera is balanced on a teetering stack of magazines. So we'll see what happens. I'm in a friend's living room.
That's a metaphor for something involving probably both of us, but I can't think of what.
It could be a stack of all the books you sold. I looked at the New York Times bestseller list hoping that you had fallen off and I could rag you about it.
Hey, I did fall off, but I'm back on it.
You're still there.
Yeah, I'm number 12 this Sunday.
Why are you back? That's attachment, Bob. Why are you back on?
I'll tell you why. Colbert followed by Charlie Rose, followed by something in the New York Times I wrote.
What was the first one?
The Colbert Show.
Oh, yeah, you were good on that.
Well, the opinions differ, I think, but it was fun.
You look good, anyway.
Oh, thank you, Mickey.
It was not a book well suited to the Colbert treatment. But
no, although apparently, you know, he's very interested. He's actually religious. Did you know that?
I believe that. I think somebody had told me that.
He's actually very interested in God, genuinely interested in God books.
And he was funny, and you made your point. So what's the problem?
I think some people thought I should have more forcefully interjected more book talking points. Spent less time helping him be funny, seemingly at my expense, maybe. But I enjoyed it. I felt great afterwards until I started talking to people with that view.
I thought you were fine, and you know, you seemed comfortable in your own skin.
Well, that's me, isn't it, Mickey?
No.
No, it's not, is it? I'll tell you, it's a good week for me. You know why?
Why?
Because yesterday I found out that I have spinal stenosis.
Sounds bad.
But you know, it's actually good. You know why?
Because Obamacare will come to your rescue.
Well, apparently not. Because compared to the thing that the doctor thought I had before the MRI, and especially compared to the thing that I thought I had after reading the MRI report myself before the doctor interpreted it and doing my own interpretation with the assistance of some feverish Googling, it's way better than that.
What did you think you had?
Well, first it was ruptured disc, which actually in the long run might be a better thing to have, but over the next few months would be more of a compromise of my lifestyle, I think. But then the MRI report says not ruptured disc. It says a bunch of stuff, including stenosis, I now realize. But the thing I focused on was disc desiccation. Now, if you Google that, it's like a relentlessly, progressively degenerative condition that leads to loss of height inexorably unless you get surgery immediately or something like that. But it turns out that, you know, as you get old, kind of a little of it happens to everybody. I mean, it's like wear and tear on your spine. It means that some of the discs have lost water. And he said, you know, for somebody your age, you know, it's not a real abnormal level of desiccation, but it had me scared to death.
This is getting more and more fascinating.
Well, I'm afraid I've exhausted my supply of knowledge about it.
Okay, well, good. Well, so the upshot is you're going to do the next Loggerheads lying on your back. Or are you doing this one lying on your back?
I'm not. No, the good news is he said pain is okay. If you take a walk and it leads to pain, you don't need to worry that you're exacerbating your condition, which under the ruptured disc scenario you would.
Huh. Pain is okay. That could be the theme of this whole segment.
Pain is okay.
Yeah.
Life is suffering, Mickey.
Well, you did go on this retreat, and you wrote this article in the New York Times about how semi-successful the last retreat was because it revealed deep insights into the structure of your mind, which you are unable to express in words. How did this one go?
Oh, actually, I could express them in words, but I chose they're kind of, that particular massive epiphany was kind of personal. But but this one was pretty good. It was the same place, the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, in the Vipassana tradition. I did meditate lying down because I thought it was a disc issue at the time, and the meditation teacher said, whatever you do with a disc, don't sit for 5.5 hours a day. And sitting does hurt it. It makes you. It leads to pain.
That's before you knew that pain was okay.
Before I knew that suffering was good. Sure. And so it's good to know how to meditate lying down, so you can put that on your resume. And it was good. I was surprised that I was able to get in the zone. Although the meditation teacher explained to me that the zone is not the place I should want to be. You should not get attached to this state. This blissful state.
That would be bad. Being attached to anything
would be
is bad. I guess.
The attachment to anything is bad. And really, you should not get attached to it. I'm not kidding.
What about your wife? Are you allowed to be attached to your wife?
Actually, in strict Buddhism, no. In the strictest Buddhism, you should be able to contemplate the loss of loved ones with almost complete indifference. That's why some people say, and it's an interesting question, whether Buddhism really borders on or crosses the threshold into nihilism. If you read some Buddhist philosophy, it's like that's what it could lead you in the direction of. Some versions of Buddhism. Nothing matters, in other words.
Well, anyway, assuming you didn't lapse into nihilism, continue with your description.
Well, what part do you want? I mean, it's intensive. The first few days were hell again. I felt almost like leaving because once I learned I couldn't do the walking meditation because that was killing my back, the slow walking, and the guy advised against it.
Well, you didn't want to become attached to this blissful state, so you moved on to the more deeply meaningful non-blissful state.
Well, I settled for less, too. The blissful state is so much like a drug in the sense that at both meditation retreats, the first time I really crossed over into it, which is like 3-4 days into the retreat, finally, after like 17 hours of meditation, it, A, feels like a drug, like presumably like heroin would feel or something. B, the next time you get into the state, it is less powerful, just as with, you know, any coffee or right. any drug, less and less powerful. And yet addictive, you still want it.
Right.
And the trouble with focusing on that state per se is that in this tradition, I think one problem is that in the Vipassana tradition, you're supposed to be doing a lot of things other than blissing out, in particular learning about the structure of your mind and the relation of thought to emotion and ultimately managing to rise above the kind of some metaphor involving a bunch of stuff like swirling around of thought and feeling in your mind and distancing yourself from it sufficiently to guide your conduct better and choose kind of which thoughts and feelings you want to engage with and so on. So and if you get too blissed out, you kind of won't do that. So you're supposed to be learning something even in the course of failing to meditate. This is a big emphasis. So like you're trying to focus on your breath, you get distracted by something, you're supposed to say, well, okay, what did I get distracted by? You know, like just focus on what just happened in your mind. You know, it's interesting that this just happened. Or you're trying to meditate and there's an annoying sound outside. Okay, where would you locate your aversion? And if you pay attention, you can locate it. You know, this is where, I mean, I noticed in fact that during meditation when somebody coughs, it annoys me in a different part of my body than if somebody belches. Did you know that, Mickey? Bet you didn't.
No.
You feel the aversion in a different part of your body. Anyway, it's all very interesting if you share my fascination with it.
But so why was it so deeply personal that you can't tell us what it was? Did you penetrate your reptilian core and locate your reptilian core?
You mean the one at the first retreat? I mean, that was mind-blowing. That was like on like night 4 or 5 of the retreat. I had not really had great... I was having growing success focusing on my breath. And finally, you know, I got in... It's like first couple of days, I can't count more than 2 breaths literally without losing my attention. Or like first day is 2, second day is 7. So I'm like getting into the 10s, and finally I'm like 100 and something breaths consecutively focusing on, and just all of a sudden I just like, you know, entered a zone. And it was a process of, I'll tell you what it was at the abstract level. It was observing the disaggregation of my mind. I mean, observing my mind as not aggregated and not unified.
Okay.
Right?
I mean, it was broken into parts.
It was broken into parts. Like, the idea, it's interesting, okay? I don't know how bored people are, but they can just skip ahead to another topic. You know, healthcare is so much
I got a couple more minutes of attention span here.
Okay, well, one thing I figured out on coming back, I started reading this famous book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, I think, which is in the Zen tradition, which is different from the Vipassana tradition. And I realized, you know, Buddhism is famous for kind of denying the existence of the self in some sense.
Right.
And I noticed there's two different aspects of that. In the Zen tradition, this book, they mean that in the sense that, and this is the way I'd classically heard it, the boundary between yourself and the world is illusory, between yourself and others is illusory. And, you know, it's like, so when you're breathing, it's just a swinging door, you know, it's like, is the metaphor in this book. It's like, you know, whatever. Anyway, but the other aspect of denying the existence of the self, which is more emphasized, I think, in the Vipassana tradition, is that the seeming unity of your mind, the seeming unity of yourself, leave aside its connection to the outside world, the seeming unity of it, like I'm the guy in charge, is an illusion. And in fact, it is a cauldron. That's kind of the word I was looking for earlier. It is a cauldron. Your mind is a cauldron of kind of competing forces. You're not thinking the thoughts. The thoughts are kind of thinking themselves, you know, and they're driven by feeling. And it's this thing, it's an illusion that you're in charge of it, kind of, which is very consistent with some parts of evolutionary psychology. And when you really observe it truly in these meditative states, as you gain the ability to get some detachment, you realize that, yeah, it's just a mess. Your mind is just, you know, all of these kind of competing forces and stuff, and it's chaos, and the way to impose order is to understand it, detach from it, and choose which thoughts and feelings you want to give play to.
It sounds Freudian, but what about the mind that is deciding which thoughts to give play to? How does that disaggregate it? Isn't that...
What about the what?
You know, you talk about you want to gain control of your mind, but and this sort of implies there's a central processing unit, and that's
excellent.
And
excellent point. This irony occurred to me on the meditation retreat is that they're saying, on the one hand, you know, there is no you, and on the other hand, you know, you can do better by kind of distancing yourself. I mean, they kind of talk that way. Maybe that's just a shorthand.
Yeah, like what's in the central processing unit, isn't that composed of like a mini version of all those roiling, you know, all those roiling Darwinian emotions?
I think maybe the idea is that normally it is, but through this practice, you can kind of crystallize out of this ordinary version of the self something that is truly removed. We're going to talk about healthcare. Over to you, Mickey.
Well, I was very pessimistic going into the summer about the prospects of healthcare because it seemed to me while the Obama administration was playing the inside game of lining up the six vote, you know, the gang of six in the Senate and getting a bill through, and once they get a bill through the Senate, then they'll come up with something from the House, and there'll be some sort of reconciliation, compromise between the two bills, and then they can apply the heavy pressure to the Democrats saying, look, you got to pass something or else you're dead meat.
Mm-hmm.
That all works but I was worried that popular support had sunk so low that the whole thing would just sort of die in the swamp, that they were arranging reconciliation on the deck of the Titanic. And support had plummeted. Now, what's happened now is that it's stabilized. It's stabilized, though, at a net negative. It's stabilized at like 55-45 against. And so the big question is that so bad that the Democrats will chicken out of doing it?
Hasn't somebody made the point that, look, once the bill is passed, if it's really okay and there aren't death panels, you know, it's not going to haunt the politicians who voted for it?
Well, the death panels aren't going to materialize by the November election. The question is...
I think maybe never, Mickey. Maybe never.
Well, I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah.
Aren't you in favor of rationing? Then you're going to have a death panel.
Rationing isn't quite the same as a death panel.
I think it is. I think that's what you were talking about. But certainly rationing on a Peter Singer model is a death panel.
If rationing is the same as a death panel, we already have death panels. Right. It's just that now the criterion is largely ability to pay. But
they're private death panels. But anyway, so that's the issue. And this thing about the public, this debate about the public option seems to me entirely kabuki. It's all designed. First, it's easily compromised. You can say, well, let any 10 states start a public option, and the other rest can only have co-ops.
Uh-huh.
It's totally susceptible to compromise, and it's designed to let the blue dog say, see, we're conservative because we squelch this liberal idea of the public option, and look how they're squawking. And it's all well designed to serve Obama's interest. That whole debate, and the press is playing it up, which also serves his interest. But the real debate is not that. The real debate is the scare that the death panel scare of seniors, and has that so poisoned public opinion that the whole thing will just stop the way immigration stopped. This whole thing reminds me of immigration. There are all these stories in the press today about how Obama's back, he's got this new strategy, and he's going to win. And that's what they were saying about immigration, too. And then it got to the Senate, and it all sort of died. Because it just wasn't popular enough. The sign of optimism is that those of us on the right, these blogs I read.
You mentioned Freud earlier in the dialogue, Mickey.
My mind is disaggregating even as we speak.
Yeah.
The little sphere of conservatism, the disaggregated segment of my mind says, well, the congressmen were going to say when they came back from vacation, please get rid of this issue for us, make it go away, and they don't seem to be saying that. So Obama has that much going for him. They're leaving the door open for saying that in the future, but they're not saying that right now. They're not saying we're so scared of the town halls that we just want this issue to go away. Please name a commission, postpone it, put it off till next year. So they're not saying that yet. I still think it's so unpopular that it's not going to happen this year, and it'll happen sometime in the spring. That's the only way I depart from the conventional wisdom. The one thing that could really screw it is if the whole Obama administration seems to be veering out of control to the left. And the one real danger sign I saw in the past week is Eric Holder not only commissioning this inquiry into the CIA, which is probably going to be unpopular enough, but also reviving the civil rights, making a sort of splash about reviving the civil rights litigation of the Carter and Clinton era, and bringing disparate impact lawsuits, including lawsuits to stop predatory lending and lawsuits to stop redlining. Well, it was the stopping of redlining, of course, that contributed to the giving of loans to people who couldn't pay them back in the current crisis. So I think that if he does too many of those things, and he may already have done too many, the public is just going to rebel. It's going to be like,
well,
don't give us any more.
This particular anxiety on the part of conservatives such as yourself, as you earlier put it,
it's only the small part of my disaggregated mind,
seems to me a little removed from the healthcare issue. So can I get back to healthcare and ask you?
It's not removed. If Obama is 80-20 unpopular in the polls, it's not going to happen.
You're just like David Brooks writing these columns where what he's got to do to get back on track is move totally to the right, like me. You know, I mean, anyway, can I ask you something directly about healthcare?
Yes.
Tim Noah on Blogging Heads made what I thought was a really kind of astute and suggestive point, which I hadn't really appreciated, that, okay, the bill as currently construed has two main things. One is like subsidies that make it easier for people to afford health insurance.
Right.
Ideally, from my point of view, the public option would be part of the way that of making accessible good insurance. And then also there's a mandate that everyone buy insurance, right?
Right.
Now, as he pointed out, the mandate is kind of a weird thing. And, you know, I mean, and people haven't really focused on it because there's been all these red herrings like death panels. But it seems to me, I mean, as he pointed out, first of all, the politics of this could lead to a situation where what Obama gives away are the subsidies, right? So, okay, we'll only subsidize them X much instead of Y much. And Meanwhile, the mandate to buy it remains, so that you increasingly move toward a bill where you're mandating that everyone pay for it without providing them the means to pay for it.
Right. And that's one of the ways it could be unpopular by election time 2010.
Well, that's so my point is, and I further think that once people quit, you know, if we ever dispel the death panel hysteria and start getting to legitimate concerns, people may kind of get, you know, hung up on this idea that the government's going to force you to pay for something without giving you, in any event, all the money to pay for it, right?
Well, if
the politics play out like this, without giving you much money for it, right?
I tend to think, and I could change my mind, and I could be completely wrong, that the mandatory quality will slide by. He can get that by. It's like mandatory car insurance. It's like paying your taxes. The Supreme Court will blow with the political winds. If it's a liberal Supreme Court, they'll say yes, and they'll say this is constitutional. And, you know, there is a real issue about will the subsidies be high enough, because it's worse than you say. There are three things that have to happen, and this is the core of reform. You have to require insurance companies not to have all these exclusions for pre-existing conditions and to give insurance policies to all comers. You have to require people to buy these policies, and you have to subsidize them enough so that they can buy these policies. The problem is the first one will raise the price, because the insurance will be more expensive if they have to give it to all comers. So that makes the other two problems even tougher, because you have to give enough subsidies to let people buy these higher-priced insurance policies. And the higher price is the first thing that's going to happen. The first thing that's going to happen is the insurance company is going to raise the price.
Okay. Well, we're close to our designated endpoint for this discussion. But I just in closing, I want to wonder if it wouldn't make more sense for Obama to try to hang on to as much of the subsidies as possible, let go of the mandatory requirement for now, and maybe institute that down the road. Because I think as the politics play out, you know, right now it's like, to make the concessions that conservatives want is this shouldn't cost so much, fewer subsidies. But I don't think for the public, to sell this to the public, that's such a big deal, really. And I think the idea of it being mandatory could become a little bit of a sticking point with the public.
Although it has to be sort of effectively mandatory for the whole thing to work, or else people will just wait until they get sick before signing up for the insurance policy where the insurance company is required to take them.
Why wouldn't it be a good thing if there were more subsidies for people who wisely use the subsidies to buy the health insurance?
Well, right, but that subsidy would have to fight this incredible imperative you've given people not to buy insurance because, hey, the company's required to take you when you get cancer. They got to pay for your $100,000 chemotherapy so you can go and buy a policy when you get sick. Save the money between now and then. That's the problem.
Oh, I see. That's an interesting point. Okay, so Mickey, everyone's wondering if we've had a Walter Cronkite moment with George Will coming out. Not quite for full withdrawal from Afghanistan, but pretty close.
I think the answer is no, because I see this as George Will making up for his guilt at endorsing the Iraq War. In other words, he endorsed the Iraq War, but he was very, very complimentary to Heather McDonald when she opposed the Iraq War on the grounds that nation building was absurd, and it wasn't, you know, Iraq wasn't ready for democracy, and it was futile. And you could tell that he regretted plumping for the Iraq War. And so
sure,
I see this as a makeup call for that.
I don't think it's quite that conscious. I think he's had a genuine kind of conversion. I think he's fed up with the neocons, and he's returned to a kind of realist sensibility. But in any event, I don't think that's so relevant to the question of how it will be perceived. I think you're maybe the only person wondering that
Didn't I predict, I think on Blogging Heads, that there'd be a right-wing revolt against the Afghan war? And I was scoffed at.
There almost already has been. I've heard David Frum sound pretty skeptical about it, but
he wrote a column.
To what extent that's just because it's Obama's war.
He wrote a column attacking George Will.
Did he?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it was bizarre. It said, Will is right about the Zen-like idiocy of our plans, what we're trying to do in Afghanistan, but he never said what he really would try to do in Afghanistan. You know, Will said, all we're trying to do is prevent al-Qaeda from coming back. Well, aren't there other places where we would prevent them from coming back, too? We're not invading them. What is Frum's goal, if not that? But no, it's a substantive critique. The right-wing's argument is, we always knew Iraq was a better place for war than Afghanistan was. That's why we didn't pay attention to Afghanistan, and we invaded Iraq. I mean, that's their argument. It's not just cynical, oh, it's Obama's war, so we'll oppose it.
No, it may not be. But in any event, I think it's an important moment. I think it's a kind of an icebreaker, if nothing else, where the prospect that the war is hopeless is really getting attention. And the fact that it's George Will makes it easier to say, let's just get the hell out of there without somebody impugning your patriotism. And so I think it's important. It's not quite Walter Cronkite, but I think it's not trivial.
George Will opposed welfare reform, and they still passed welfare reform.
I didn't say, that
even the conservative George Will opposed it.
Yeah. Well, okay. I turned to Frederick Kagan for his response, the architect of the surge policy.
Yeah.
He had a post in National Review. He starts it off by quoting, you know, George Will had used the term risible. Is that the way you
risible,
pronounce it? Not risible, risible?
I think it's risible, but I could be wrong.
Risible? He says, George Will may find the British contribution to the Afghanistan mission risible. A rather offensive statement considering the number of soldiers Britain has lost in Afghanistan. I mean, this is his opening note. First of all, he's just wrong. George Will didn't say that.
He said the NATO contribution was sometimes
risible. He said the NATO
risible.
Contribution is, quote, reluctant and often risible. Yeah. He's clearly not talking about the largest contribution, which is Britain's, but these trivial contributions.
Okay, so you got Kagan there.
Well, yeah, but it's also pervades his post. It's the beginning and the end, tugging at heartstrings in this neocon way, using this line to do it, you know. He does it again at the end, you know, disparaging the efforts of allies who have shed their own blood alongside our troops as a, you know, blah, blah, blah.
But okay, this is the standard right-wing reaction as you try to read the guy out of the movement as opposed to deal with his arguments.
Yeah, well, at least get your damn facts straight. This is pathetic.
But it's clearly too early.
So the heart of his thing, though, the heart of Kagan's thing is he says, look, a 1-to-50 ratio of troops to civilians that is called for in counterinsurgency doctrine would mean 320,000 counterinsurgents in Afghanistan. And then he tries to make the case that that's plausible. Okay, well, we've got 70,000 in there. He admits that the Afghani police are a joke, but he says the troops, the soldiers aren't so bad. He says there's 90,000 of those. Okay, that's 160, halfway to 320. And he says, and that 90 can be expanded to 140,000 next year. Well, that seems pretty fast. And perhaps to 240,000 within a couple of years after that. So perhaps to 240 within, it sounds to me like totally wishful thinking. And, if anything, you know, once the insurgency starts picking up steam as it is, you got to downsize your estimates of how rapidly a coherent and engaged military force can be built there.
I'm not so sure these numbers,
and Kagan almost single-handedly persuaded me it's hopeless.
Did you read O'Hanlon's piece in the Wall Street Journal? It was more optimistic.
No, what did he say?
Well, he said the non-Pashtun areas don't like the Taliban, and so they're a ready source of troops, and that the army was... He agreed the army was good, and the police, he said the police weren't totally hopeless.
Right, but by the same token, Mickey, the troops of that ethnic identity are not going to be a very effective counterinsurgency troops in Pashtun areas where the problem is, right?
Good point, but aren't our troop levels in Iraq were way below what the 3-to-1 ratio would have dictated too, and yet
it's 50-to-1.
It hasn't been a disaster. It clearly seems to me it's too early for Obama just for you know reasons of projection of power to turn around in Afghanistan. Oh hey, we tried it for a couple of months and it didn't work, so we're getting out of here. After a year of trying and adjusting to the enemy's strategy, if it's still a disaster, then it makes more sense. It doesn't make any sense to leave right now.
Yeah, well, okay, but the fundamental question is this, which is kind of raised in Will's column, is like, which is more important, Pakistan or Afghanistan? The Afghanistan effort has, from the beginning, come at the expense of keeping a stable Pakistan, because the successful war initially drove the Taliban into Pakistan, where they are destabilizing a country that has nuclear weapons. Now, it may come down to, what would you rather have, Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, threatening to seize control of nuclear weapons or a whole country containing them, or would you rather give them Afghanistan?
If we give them Afghanistan, they're going to leave Pakistan? Why would they leave Pakistan?
What?
If we give them Afghanistan, they're going to leave Pakistan? Why?
Because Afghanistan is where a lot of them wanted to be in the first place. Now, I don't know enough about is where they came from. I don't know enough to know. Now, there is this continuity of Pashtun areas that crosses borders, so I don't know enough to say how clearly that kind of solves the problem. I've got to think it would defuse problems.
I don't understand. They're embedded in Pakistan now. They moved to Pakistan. The combined forces of the United States and the Pakistani army are unable to root them out because the populace is hospitable to them. Why would they then suddenly leave for no good reason other than there's this other place they could go to?
Look, some of the ones in Pakistan are kind of darting back and forth across the border because their real objective is to fight in Afghanistan. I've got to think if they won, they'd just move to Afghanistan.
Don't be silly there.
Look, I don't know. I'm not an expert.
They'll take both places.
I'm not an expert, but I do think there's good reason to think that things may get grim enough that you kind of have to choose what do you want to give them, a country with nuclear weapons or without. And
I agree, but unless you can show me that the effort in Afghanistan is now currently, not what it did a year ago, but currently destabilizing Pakistan, then it seems to me it's too early.
Well, no, what I'm saying is that their failure to possess Afghanistan is destabilizing Pakistan. It may be a grim choice. And I also don't know how do you do the transition, you know? It's like, I mean, George Will was saying, well, okay, all we leave in place is a few special ops people and then use, the remotely fired missiles, drones to kill people along the border area. But in a certain sense, don't you want to open up the border? Isn't that what he's saying? Kind of let them in. And my point is just there are huge transition problems, and you kind of obviously don't want to make it your policy objective to give Afghanistan to the Taliban unless you could negotiate a solution. And of course, the other thing is you really, really would like the deal. A better deal would be, the best form of giving the Afghanistan to Taliban is to at least get them to say it won't be a home for anti-American terrorists.
Well, what leverage do we have if we're about to beg them to leave Pakistan and go to Afghanistan? What leverage do we have to say no bases? Why won't they establish bases?
Yeah. I have no idea, and I'm saying I don't understand how the transition works. All I'm saying is that it may be the choice we face. Which do you want? Pakistan or Afghanistan? And the other thing is that from a realist point of view, an Afghanistan run by however reactionary and authoritarian a government that does not harbor anti-American terrorists is no immediate threat to American interests in the short run.
Well, I don't think anybody would dispute that, but then you're reinforcing the neocon argument, which is they knew that a democratic government in Iraq would be a beacon to the Middle East and would be an important improvement. A democratic government in Afghanistan, not so important. That's why they focused on Iraq.
I don't know.
They say we can be realists in Afghanistan, but by being idealists in Iraq, we actually accomplish something, which is to show Arabs
Look,
that democracy is impossible.
Is Iraq a better place to try to institute a government of any kind in Afghanistan? Yes. Is that by itself? Because Afghanistan has never been subject to sustained, coherent, centralized control of any kind. It's always been a place that was very hard to govern, except in the most decentralized way. So in that sense, maybe that by itself doesn't make the case that invading Iraq was a good idea.
We're
near the end of this segment, and I got a little house cleaning to do, but given the way your computer's behaving, we should close. Okay, just a little housekeeping to take care of here. Originally, Mickey was part of this discussion, but this part of his series of files, video files, met with some sort of misfortune. So it's just me. A few quick things to comment on. First of all, Apollo Project. I know we started talking about this a long time ago. It's finally going to launch. This is the deal where commenters can argue with one another on video in dialogues in a special part of the site, the Apollo Theater, as it were. Or, you know, viewers who aren't commenters can argue with one another or with commenters or whatever. If you're interested in participating, email us at apollo@bloggingheads.tv. Each one of these will just be single topic, 5 to 15 minutes. We can provide tech support. We'll match you up with a partner if you don't have somebody in mind. But if you're already in an argument with somebody in the comments section, maybe you should just take that to video. These in the past, dialogues often have a civilizing effect, you know. So even if there's somebody you're in a flame war with, and I'm about to visit the subject of flame wars, you never know. Could be good, could be bad. What's the worst that could happen? Now, there's one feature of these which has to do with the fact that I think the kind of visual anonymity of commenters is a nice thing. The fact that nobody can see what you look like when you're arguing with each other, because then these various kind of non-meritocratic factors that sometimes influence the effectiveness of discourse don't come into play. You know, the way social psychologists have shown that, you know, tall people are more persuasive, or people wearing lapels or whatever. So I would like to... I want to start out... Not everyone in Blogging Heads thinks this is a great idea. In fact, it may be that no one thinks it's even a good idea except for me. But I would, at least at the beginning, we may change, at least at the beginning, I would like to use a kind of a masking effect on people, a kind of quasi-masking effect. Not out-and-out avatars. It's not like you're going to look like a lizard. Unless you want. If you've got software that turns you into a lizard, more power to you. You can submit the clip that way. But in any event, we are going to provide our own masking over whatever is submitted, and it's going to look like this or something like that. And by the way, I'm wondering, you know, if you light yourself asymmetrically with this masking software, it may even further... Does that further conceal my identity? Or what? I mean, what are we up to here? I don't know. Anyway, with lighting, you can probably influence the degree of masking. I don't know. But, email us if you're interested. apollo@bloggingheads.tv. I said I would get back to the subject of flame wars. Here I come. There have been complaints that there have been more and more flame wars in the comment section. And a growing incivility. These are complaints by some of the commenters themselves. One of our commenters pointed out that unlike many sites, we do not have formal guidelines that might encourage civil behavior. So we have developed a draft of comment guidelines. It's just a draft. It's linked to here, unless it's linked to there, in which case I would look in that direction. We solicit your comments. So we want you to comment on the comments guidelines, and then we will refine them in light of your feedback, and then we will have a guidelines policy, just like a real website. Finally, the creationism kind of brouhaha may have come to your attention when we posted a dialogue involving an adherent of intelligent design, and then took it down from the site at the request of one of the participants, and then put it back up on the site, seemingly exhibiting erratic behavior. What actually happened is I explained in a little post under the dialogue after it was reinstated was that I was away and incommunicado when the decision to pull the thing from the site was made, the reasonable thing to do in light of the request of the participant, but I decided it was really not a precedent we could live by, so we reinstated it. Now, in that post, I said that this had led us to realize we should generate some sort of statement of kind of principles, some sort of statement about how it is we, you know, what criteria people who appear on the site meet and so on, and the business of, you know, whether you should be in the business of taking dialogues down once they're posted and so on. And we needed a policy that would shed at least some light. So we've generated that. That also is linked to either there or there. It's like, I think it's there. I'm not dyslexic, but I do not have great spatial orientation, I've got to say. Now, I think the Post may have led some people to believe the Statement of Principles was going to shed light in a very direct way on this controversy, which, as you, some of you know, has led to two blogging heads who have participated in Science Saturday in the past say they no longer will. Actually, the Statement of Principles does not shed a lot of light on that, except in a general way. It's not designed to do that. For people who want to hear more about that and our position on that and our policy going forward on specifically on kind of, you know, creationist ID people, that is intelligent design adherents. First of all, George Johnson and I will be discussing this on Science Saturday this Saturday. George, I think, holds the view that you shouldn't have these people on the website. And I hold the view that you certainly shouldn't completely exclude it, although I will articulate fairly, I think, clear and even narrow guidelines regarding under what circumstances it makes sense to have them on the site in the course of my dialogue with George. And in addition, I think, you know, eventually I should have some sort of written statement about this whole controversy. We'll probably have that prepared by the time Science Saturday airs, and we'll link to it from there. So I think that's the three things I was supposed to discuss. Comments, Apollo Project, creationism. So we've got two links for you here. The draft of comments policy for your input, the statement of principles or philosophy, I'll tell you again, the email address if you want to participate in the Apollo Project is apollo@bloggingheads.tv. Don't worry about what equipment you have. We can almost certainly get you going, and we will do the technical hand-holding. And I think this could be great. I think this could lead to great things. Or could be a total fiasco. Either way. But I'm very interested to see how this masking software works. So thanks, and I'll see you next time.